has an office over there.
Right. That's so. But.
All right. So, you know, when writing this up, it's always a little hard to judge who the audience is. So I just wanted to put up kind of my just general context with, you know, a little bit of the sort of physics spin on it. I'm really interested in singular varieties that have symplectic structures on them. What a symplectic structure and a singular variety is, well, we can discuss that a little bit because, you know, obviously you usually learn that as something about tangent spaces, and singular varieties don't have very nice tangent spaces. But you can make that precise. And one really nice way these sorts of singularities come up is when you have an n equals 4 supersymmetric three-dimensional gauge theory. So I'm fixing a gauge group, which secretly I'm assuming is compact and connected. So I should allow things like tori products of u1s or un. I think that's what physicists would say. I'll usually think of the complex version of the group, so I'll write GLN instead of UN, that sort of thing. All right, and I have to choose some matter, which is a representation of that group. All right, and out of this, I get moduli space of vacua. That moduli space of vacua, because of the N equals 4 supersymmetry, is a algebraic variety over C with a holomorphic symplectic structure. All right. And that moduli space of vacua has two particularly nice pieces. So, you know, this theory has some fields. And one way to think about what the branches are is thinking about which of the fields vanish. So there are some fields that are adjoint and some fields that live in T star of V. All right, so the Higgs branch is the fields in the adjoint vanish, and I only am getting stuff that lives down on V. And this is supposed to be vacua, so it's some minimum of energy. The energy is actually the norm squared of some complex moment map. So being a vacuum, having minimal energy, means that this complex moment map vanishes, and then I have to mod out by the action of my gauge group. And so I'm taking a symplectic quotient for this group G. If I think about the compact group, it's a hyperkähler quotient. Just depends on how I want to think about things. All right, so this is sort of geometry that mathematicians are pretty comfortable with, right? Just have some nice vector space, I have some function on it, zero set, you know, a level of that function. Okay, it's singular algebraic variety, but it's a perfectly good algebraic variety, and I get sort of nice, fun algebraic geometry modding out by the group and looking at geometric invariant theory, this sort of stuff. All right, but then there's this other kind of more mysterious piece of the moduli space of vacua where the fields in the matter vanish, but I still have the adjoint fields. The fact that I get the adjoint fields, well, if you sort of go through, if you go through everything, this means that I get T star of the dual torus to the torus in my group. So note that doesn't depend on the representation. And I mod out by the action of the file group, because again, I'm modding out by gauge. So I'm looking at fields in the adjoint. I can conjugate those. They have to commute. So part of being a vacuum is that they all commute. And so I can conjugate them to all live in a torus, but not uniquely. It's only up to the action of the file group that acts on that torus. All right. But I say close to this because then, I don't know, every time I would talk to physicists, they would tell me, oh yeah, it's basically this thing, but that's only classically. There are some quantum corrections. And I would say, who's a what now? And they would never really explain what was going on. So for about 10 years of my life, I kind of knew that this was this interesting thing and knew about some interesting examples and could not possibly tell you, like, what the examples had to do with the definition or what the definition was or what was going on here. Now, luckily, there are some other people who were also interested in this and didn't give up as easily and thought a little harder about the matter.
What was this sign at the end of the previous page?
you don't know the shruggy?
No.
Well, it's an emoji of a person going, mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. So luckily you didn't know about the shruggy, so you kept plugging away at things. Nakajima also deserves a lot of credit for figuring this out. They figured out that, you know, what you were supposed to look at is essentially some geometry we already know about Hecke modifications, but where we also involve some stuff about sections of the associated bundle with fiber given by this representation. All right, so, right, I've got my group, I've got my representation. I can look at Taylor series in those things. So, this G with the Taylor series, I have a formal disk, and I think about sort of how I could have like transition functions on the formal disk between two principal bundles, for example. Or you can think of that as automorphisms of the trivial principal bundle on the formal disk. And V, Taylor series in that, I think of as sections of the trivial bundle on that formal disk with fiber given by the representation V. And here I have Laurent series in the same things. So that's exactly the same thing, but thought of on a punctured disk. So what I want to do, I wrote this kind of funny thing, consider moduli, I have Hecke modifications on the formal disk at the origin zero, together with compatible sections of the associated bundle with fiber V. So what does that mean? That means I look at a principal bundle on the disk, which of course is trivial, but I don't think of it as having any particular trivialization. I choose a trivialization on the punctured disk, and I also choose a section of the associated bundle with fiber V. Okay? So what people will usually tell you is that the affine Grassmannian is the collection of principal bundles on the disk with a trivialization chosen on the punctured disk, or some people would say a trivialization at infinity. So I'm adding in an extra piece of information here, which is a section of the bundle, but not of the original principal bundle, of the associated bundle with fiber V. And remember, this vector bundle is always trivial. So what I'm always getting as the fiber over each point in the affine Grassmannian, right? I have a map down to the affine Grassmannian, which is forget the section. The set of choices I have is always V, Taylor series in V, this VO, but not canonically VO. So in particular, right, if I use my trivial bundle to really think of this section as an element of VK, it might have a pole or it might have zero at the origin. So I might have chosen a trivialization that didn't extend over the origin. All right. So you can accept that explanation, or you can just say, well, think about the associated bundle and don't worry too much. All right.
Associated to the GO bundle over the
to the G bundle on the disk. Right? I have a principal bundle for G on the disk. I get an associated vector bundle on the disk whose fiber on each point is V. What is a section of that bundle? It's an element of Taylor series in V.
I meant this statement that Y is the associated bundle for VO.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. The associated bundle with fiber VO on the affine Grassmannian.
The GO bundle over.
Yeah, well, the sort of obvious GO bundle on the affine Grassmannian, which is take quotient by the right action of GO. Right, I mean, oh, can I do this?
this is equal to GK times VO modulo the action of G of O, where it acts on GK by right multiplication by the inverse and on VO by the obvious thing. Okay. All right. So what I want to consider is pairs of these two things that match on the disk minus a point. So this is Hecke modifications. This is ways of changing the principal bundle and the section, but without changing things away from up. So I think about pairs of bundles with section, such that the sections agree on away from the origin. And a way I can do that is I can take two bundles, I can trivialize them away from the origin, I can use that trivialization to identify them, and then what do I need to check to see that everything's well defined? Well, I need to check that I get the same element of VK by looking at the section on the disk minus the point, and then I have to mod out by the different ways of choosing a trivialization, which is an action of GK. So that's what I have here. I choose a section and a bundle on the disk. I choose a section and a bundle on the disk. Can think about, I want to get a section and a bundle on the ravioli, where I take these two disks and identify them away from the origin. And all that's saying is I have to check that the sections match up, and then think, oh, I don't want to choose this with a trivialization away from the origin. So I want to mod out by the different ways of choosing those. This VK is going to act, GK is going to act freely. No, don't go to sleep. Don't go to sleep. All right. Cool. So whenever I have a space with this structure, where I've taken one space mapping down onto something else, and I've taken the fiber product with itself, I should get a convolution product on the equivariant homology. Now, this is one of these things that should hurt your head if you start thinking about it too carefully, because like everything in the picture is infinite dimensional. And it starts getting a little weird if you think about it. So in this product, the identity is represented by the diagonal copy of W. So where I just take the same bundle and section on each copy of the disk and glue them together. And that guy is both infinite dimensional and infinite codimensional. So what I really want when I write down this homology guy is things that are sort of finite dimensionally different from the diagonal. And luckily, I get to refer to one of Sasha's papers with his collaborators and say, well, they worked out all the technical stuff in there, so I don't need to worry about it. You know what? All you have to do with this stuff is sort of calculate and love the bomb. Like, just pretend that algebraic topology works the way you expect it to. You just sort of need to assume a few theorems, and everything will work out. All right, so that, if I just take equivariant homology for GK, what I end up getting is a commutative ring. And I can take the spectrum of that commutative ring, and that's the Coulomb branch. So we're finding the Coulomb branch by describing the functions. And there is some funny physics reason why you should think of this as like the Hilbert space for S2 in some three-dimensional theory, and you should think of this product as putting two spheres inside a bigger sphere and gluing your elements of the Hilbert space into those guys and getting an element of the Hilbert space of the outside. And then the commutativity is obvious because you can take the two spheres and you can switch them. Well, we're in three dimensions. You can take the two spheres and switch them.
Subject, I assume B is Sasha,
and
who are F and N?
Oh, Finkelberg and Nakajima. Yeah, maybe I should have written that somewhere. And please, if you have any other questions, go ahead and stop me. All right, whew. But I should also not be too slow. So let me just note
There are a lot of things I'm going to mention, and I'm going to say, okay, you should kind of remember that this thing is in there, but you also shouldn't worry too much about it. So I want to deform this algebra and get something non-commutative. And the secret to the non-commutativity is to add in a C star. And if you believe this story about the two S2s inside a bigger S2, what's going on is I'm taking this picture and I'm making it equivariant for the U1 that rotates the whole picture. So inside here, I can take two smaller spheres that are invariant under that rotation, but I can't switch them in a way that's invariant under that rotation.
What do you mean, switch them under the
invariant? I mean that if I take any sort of path where I smoothly deform things to send one sphere to the other, it will have to pass through a configuration that's not invariant under U. I believe the physics word for this is omega background. So this is what sort of turns on the non-commutativity. And I'll just note, somehow this way of extending the C star action to Y is not canonical. I get to choose, I have an extra choice of C star acting on V, but that's got to commute with my original gauge group. So I end up with this flavor group, the automorphisms of V under the action of G. I can think about that acting as well. So I have the flavor group times GK that acts on this whole picture with F just acting on the vector space V in the obvious way. And I also have this loop rotation. And I end up with a big deformed algebra. And here H bar is the equivariant parameter for this loop C star action. And this algebra actually has a big center, which is maybe not that big, there might be bigger ones later, which is given by the equivariant cohomology of a point for not quite the flavor mod its intersection with the group G, which is the center of the group G. So that gives me a big commutative subalgebra, and modding out by a maximal ideal of that gives me a quantization of my original Coulomb branch. All right, so this is sort of the basic construction. How are we actually supposed to understand it? Like, how on earth are we supposed to think about all of this stuff? There's a lot of like kind of complicated algebraic topology here. And my kind of message in this talk is there's actually a way of thinking about all of these things and answering any question you want about this algebra that actually requires you to do absolutely no thought about algebraic topology. If you just believe me, that the thing I'm describing to you has some algebraic topology behind it, then you can just forget about these spaces, forget about Hecke modifications. You only have to know about like pictures and polynomial rings. All right, this is another one of these things I just want to flash up really quickly, tell you you should remember this somewhere in the back of your mind, but don't worry too much. If I look at the torus of the flavor group, I can look at the group generated by my original gauge group and then adding in that torus to make a kind of bigger gauge group acting on the same representation. That gives me a sort of bigger space MF, the Coulomb branch of this bigger group. And my original Coulomb branch is actually a symplectic. Oh, no. Sorry. There's something missing here. I have a torus which acts. And what I'm doing is sort of the naive way of doing a Hamiltonian reduction on an algebra. So.
Where did you put H and not F?
Oh, H is defined in the line above.
Oh, I see.
Because I didn't throw in the full action of F. So I could sort of try to do this with all of F, but I feel better just using the torus. Somehow it makes me happier. So.
Just trying to track translation. Little dot means the central product, I assume.
Little dot. Where's little?
F dot G.
I literally mean the subgroup generated by both of those inside GLV. And they commute, so like it is a products group. I mean, the point is they have non-trivial intersection. So it's not the Cartesian product, it's the Cartesian product modulo some subgroup. And what's that subgroup? Well, yeah. And that's exactly why there's this H here. The H here is the torus of the flavor modulo the part of that that was already in the gauge group. Anyways, point is, don't worry about it. There's this bigger guy. I get my original singular affine variety by doing the kind of reduction you do for affine varieties. I look at invariant functions, I mod out by setting the moment map to zero, and then I say, ah, I have an algebra, I can take spec of that. But there's a more fancy thing you can do, which is called GIT quotient, and that will get you something that's not an affine variety. That will be a partial symplectic resolution of the affine variety I defined, and in many interesting cases will be a symplectic resolution. All right? So don't worry about it. Just remember that there's a sort of Coulomb branch way to resolve these guys. And all the constructions for that I'm going to talk about that have to do with affine varieties, you can also come along for the ride to these resolutions. So notable examples, if my gauge group is abelian, then what I get is actually the Higgs branch of another different abelian theory. For this guy I'm calling G perp, which is a subgroup of the Langlands dual of diagonal matrices acting on V. The fancy word for that is Gale duality. Slotovy slices in type A show up as the Coulomb branches of certain type A gauge theories. The important thing to note here is I'm looking at the nilpotent orbits whose Jordan types are described by these partitions, lambda and mu. And here I just hand to you the dimension vector for a type A quiver gauge theory. And this is somehow rank level dual to the data you would put in to get the same Slotovy slice as the Higgs branch, the Nakajima quiver variety for this quiver. All right. So the difference is whether you index nilpotent orbits by the original partition or its transpose. So whether you look at Jordan type or you look at the dimensions of kernels of the powers. All right. And then more generally, if you put in ADE quiver, the Coulomb branches of the quiver gauge theories are slices between Schubert varieties in the affine Grassmannian. Where again, you know, there's a nice relationship between the co-weights lambda mu indexing the Schubert varieties and the dimension vectors I put into quiver variety. And for other quivers, well, you should think maybe there's some kind of affine Grassmannian thing out there that this is telling you something about. And in affine type A, you again get a Nakajima quiver variety for rank level dual data. And I'll just say for all of these, doing this GIT construction I mentioned gives you an actual resolution of singularities. So that won't always happen in general, but in these cases it will. Any questions? So the problem I'm trying to get to is, so we have this construction. We know it gives us interesting algebras because we know, number one, it gives us something we would kind of like to know out of general physics motivation. It gives us a big, new, interesting supply of these symplectic singularities, which at least I like, and it gives us certain special cases we already knew about and knew were interesting. The question is, how do we get anything out of this geometric description? In particular, what I'd really like to understand is the representation theory. And that's kind of tricky. So there's this thing called the monopole formula, which is basically you say, ah, the affine Grassmannian has this decomposition into Schubert cells, so I can use that to sort of break things up. One way to say this is, you know, if I look at this fiber product of y cross y, there's a map down to the affine Grassmannian, which is, forget the section. Sorry, it's a map down to the affine Grassmannian cross the affine Grassmannian. And of course, the choice of sections is going to be constant on orbits of GK on the affine Grassmannian times the affine Grassmannian, which are indexed by double cosets in the affine Weyl group of the finite Weyl group. So you get a nice decomposition of the algebra indexed by those double cosets, which are the same thing as dominant weights, and it's relatively easy to describe the Hilbert series of each of those pieces. So you find out something about the structure of this algebra. So I, you know, this is an interesting piece of information, and some physicists, Hanani was the one who told me about this, at least, had sort of guessed that this was the right Hilbert series for the Coulomb branch. But if you want the representation theory, knowing what this algebra is up to, this is basically up to some sort of associated graded, is not very useful. So you sort of know what happens when you multiply two of these up to lower order terms, but the lower order terms are really important if you want to understand the representation theory. All right, so I want to use a different approach, which is, instead of the affine Grassmannian, I'm going to use the affine flag variety. So this is gotten by taking an Iwahori. So rather than just looking at G of O, I look at elements of G of O, such that when I specialize T to 0, I get something in the Borel. The quotient of G of K by the Iwahori is usually called the affine flag variety. For GLN, the way to think about it is it's lattices, v0, v1, vn, v2, v3, up to vn minus 1, such that, I forgot to write this in, the inclusion has codimension 1. So when I come back around here, I get something that has codimension n, and it has to be t times my original lattice. So this is sort of a cyclic flag. It's a flag where all the steps have codimension 1, but if I multiply all the vector spaces by t, I just shift over by n steps. That's what I would call an affine flag. All right. Well, I can imitate exactly what I did before. I can take the associated bundle for V of 0, now for the Iwahori. And this is introducing kind of one additional piece of information. So I've still got a principal bundle, and a section of the associated V bundle, a trivialization away from the origin. And then at the origin, I'm essentially choosing a flag. But it's a flag, you know, in sort of the fiber at the origin. So it's something which is isomorphic to the group, but not canonically. All right. So I have a map down to this guy I was calling Y before, with fiber given by G mod B, which is forgetting this flag at the origin. All right. So I can define this Still working on the technology here. I apologize about that. So I can take this fiber product again. And why do I prefer to do that? Well, the really, really short version is I would rather have something that corresponded to the affine Weyl group than double cosets in the affine Weyl group. The affine Weyl group has much better structure than the set of double cosets because it's a group. So if you come away from this talk knowing nothing else, just know it's much better to be able to use the actual affine Weyl group and be able to multiply group elements. In particular, you know, somehow, as often happens, you can kind of reduce everything down to simple reflections. There are no simple reflections in double cosets. All right. But if you're interested in representation theory, not very much changes, because whether I use X or I use Y, I get Morita equivalent algebras. So making this change doesn't hurt very much. It actually gives me a Morita equivalent thing, and the bimodule is sort of the obvious fiber product you would guess. All right. So I'm just changing to a Morita equivalent algebra, but in representation theory, often you can get a lot of mileage out of choosing a Morita equivalent algebra that has a nice presentation.
All right. So flags are better than Grassmannians. Just always, whenever you're doing something about Grassmannians, ponder whether you could do it about flags instead. So in particular, once we're choosing flags, we get natural homology classes in this product that correspond to the simple roots. And they correspond to the locus where the section stays the same. The only thing I change is what the flag is, and I change it by something whose relative position is less than SI. That's sort of the general framework. It's much better to think about this in terms of flags, which is when I'm thinking about GLN, I can think about, I have this periodic flag, and I look at the subset of the product where I only change one of the spaces in the flag, and I leave all the other ones the same. So that's a P1's worth of choices. So part of what's going on here is P1 is much nicer than an arbitrary Grassmannian. Yes?
So can you say again why flags are better than Grassmannian?
Because P1 is better than having an arbitrary Grassmannian. Whenever you do calculations involving the flag variety, you usually can boil things down to P1s. So just as an example, taking Bott-Samuelson resolutions, right, correspond to choosing a reduced decomposition. But when you want to resolve something in a Grassmannian or some other partial flag variety, it's much more complicated. So, and of course, in a talk like this, some of this you're just going to have to take on blind faith, but I can try to explain more later. We might also sort of, it might be a little clearer in a few slides. Maybe, I don't know, we'll see.
So when you pass from this y to x, there was no any choice involved. I mean, you don't need this.
There's no choice involved.
So now, sometimes you do something different. Somehow when you say, suppose you have some kind of quiver theory, you need to, sometimes to do some things, you need to choose some flag inside of quiver. You don't need this here, right? I mean, you just find one algebra, which in the Wahori case is just one.
Well, okay. Again, if you let me get a few slides later, I think I'll argue that you do want to think about all the different ways of choosing different things. So,
but it will be kind of literally the same construction about which you're going to think differently, or you're going to have some variance with this construction.
I'm going to have some variance.
Okay.
I think that there's a physical construction which this construction I think has a physical interpretation.
How would you say, like breaking symmetry to the torus or something?
Right. So there is this Google Vinton type of defect that you can define in gauge theories in general in three dimensional, we call dimension two. So you break the gauge group to the subgroup.
So maybe that's what's going on.
I wonder what Marita Kunos means in this class.
Well, this difference can end.
This difference.
So if you put a defect along the center, the place where your operators live, then modify the algebra because now you can local operators on the defect. Then this defect might end. And then there will be local operators at the endpoint of the defect. And these are the module, which implements the Morita equivalence. But the fact is the Morita equivalence is not obvious.
All right, well, we can talk about it later. I'm running very low on time as it is. So one thing to note here, what always happens with these convolution algebras is they act on the homology of the space you're taking the fiber product of. So before I would have gotten an action on the homology of Y, which is, I wrote the wrong thing here, shoot. Sorry about this. I shouldn't have written B of G, I should have written B of T. So I get an action on a polynomial ring. And these guys I'm describing here, where I choose one of these spaces and let one of them change, acts by this de Maizière operator. And that de Maizière operator is exactly corresponding to the P1 that comes from my options for changing this space while leaving the ones on either side of it fixed.
All right, so this is what's sort of better about P1. But this is sort of seems a little silly, right? I added in this auxiliary choice of a flag, and then I thought about the different ways to change that flag. That's not getting me anywhere. So I need something else. I also need to have operators that change the actual principal bundle. But that ends up introducing this kind of complication, which is I have to think about changing both the principal bundle, so one of the pieces of my flag, so there's some P1's worth of choices there, but it also changes what are acceptable sections. So, right, I'm doing this sort of HECA modification. The whole thing that I'm looking at is I have principal bundles on my two different disks that are glued away from the origin, and I'm looking at sections on both of them that agree away from the origin.
What is an acceptable section?
It means ones that don't have a pole at the origin. Right, so changing the principal bundle by a HECA modification basically means changing your mind about what it means to have a zero or a pole at the origin. So when I say acceptable sections, I mean that it changes, you know, somehow I need to have sections that don't have a pole at the origin in either one of my disks. And from the perspective of one disk, that's imposing additional conditions. And those additional conditions have an algebraic topological consequence of multiplying by some normal bundle, the Euler class of some normal bundle. So the secret in all of this stuff is you always just sort of remember that you know, pulling back and pushing forward to a subvariety is the same as multiplying by the Euler class of the normal bundle. All right, so I have to, what I want to do is think about spaces where I choose a principal bundle and meromorphic sections that have particular kind of poles. And those particular kind of poles pay attention to what the flag is. So the way, the sort of words I'm saying here is I want to separate out that operation of saying, ooh, this section is no good anymore, which before it was just, does it have a zero? Does it have a pole or doesn't it? And changing what the actual principal bundle is. So what I want to do is have some more sophisticated notion of acceptable section. So instead of just saying, you know, does it have a pole or not, I sort of say, okay, on different weight spaces, different amounts of pole are allowed, which if you're thinking in terms of, you know, reduction to the Borel, this is saying that, like, you know, the zero or pole in terms of the Borel is some fixed thing. And if I lie inside a particular alcove, I'm going to get a subspace which is invariant under the Iwahori, but no longer necessarily under G of O. So I'm going to get something that gives me an acceptable vector bundle on the affine flag variety, but the zeros or poles I allow sort of depends on what the flag is. So it isn't a vector bundle on the affine Grassmannian anymore. All right, are there any questions? And the reason I'm doing this is if I want to sort of think about changing what my principal bundle is, it's very hard to do the kind of calculations of how that acts on the polynomials. But if I break it up into these different smaller pieces, each one of them will act in a simpler way.
I'm sure I understand. So this changes, this gives you a family of x's?
Yes, it gives you a family of x's.
And now you have tensor.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm going to do.
So can you just go back for a second? I mean, so lambda is an element of what? It's an element of.
So lambda is an element of the real Lie algebra of the torus.
Real Lie algebra of the torus.
Yeah. So this means to each weight space, I assign a real number.
Okay.
And I use that real number to tell me kind of what's an acceptable zero or pole. Right? So, you know, it's roughly I take that real number and I say, well, I can't have a pole worse than that real number. There's some stupid halves hiding in there because, you know, halves show up It's very annoying, but it happens. So the important sort of thing is when I choose an element of this torus, that gives me a real number for every weight space, and that real number tells me what kind of pole or zero I allow. That's kind of the lesson here. Right, so this is something where it's only going to change when that real number passes through an integer and you suddenly say, oh, that kind of zero or that kind of pole, either that's allowed now or it's not allowed now. And sort of the important thing is this is kind of a continuous process and it never happens at the same time that I change one of the vector spaces in my flag. So I separate out those two things that happen, the you know, which things are acceptable and which things change my flag. All right, so I can define a bigger category where the objects are elements of this real torus of the Lie algebra, and the morphisms are, the equivariant homology of this fiber product. All right. And so my original algebras are endomorphism spaces in this bigger category, but it's easier to think about how things behave in this category because I can break elements of my algebra up into products of morphisms in this category that don't go from one thing to the other.
I mean, is that the original algebra is endomorphism, but is it true? Because I thought that somehow if you fix lambda, if you like consider lambda equal to lambda prime, you don't get what you were doing before, right?
If lambda is zero. If lambda is zero, I get back the sort of original BFN thing with the affine Grassmannian. And if I take sort of a generic perturbation of zero, I get this affine flag variety thing. And in fact, I shouldn't just say zero, actually near any integral coweight, I get that. So if I go to a different integral coweight, I'm looking at the same space, but I'm describing it a little bit differently. So the interesting thing is sort of going from one to the other, I pass through things that aren't the original picture. All right, so actually let me put up.
Would it be correct to say that you have as many different, that you have basically as many such things as there are parabolic subgroups, or is it the?
No, it's more than that. So here's this example. So this is the example of GL2 with the vector space being C2. And as I said, when I'm here at zero, this isn't such a good one, but that's okay. When I'm here at zero, I get the original C2. And so I'm getting back the original algebra. And as I move around in this space, whenever I pass one of these red lines, that's when one of the weights has an half integral value. And those are the moments where my acceptable sections change. So going here, right, being here, this means I look at sections, meromorphic sections, that sort of have a pole or better in one term and no pole in the other term. And when I go here to the other side, I flip my two vectors.
But also says that basically when you shift this thing by an integral value, then somehow essentially you get the same thing, right?
Yeah, so...
But for slightly less trivial reason.
Everything in the picture is equivariant under the action of the affine Weyl group. So if I get things that correspond under the affine Weyl group, then I'll get the same thing. But... if I take a more, and in this case, all the chambers are in one orbit under the affine Weyl group, but that won't always happen.
So it's not true that this thing depends only on the stabilizer of your weight of the Weyl.
No. No, there are sort of other things that you're passing through. Sorry, guys. I'm really running out of time, but I'll talk about this in Toronto in a bit over a week, and we'll talk about some more specific examples and learn more.
Okay, so what are the morphisms in this category that I want to think about? And kind of all of them involve changing the underlying object. So going back to the same place is going to involve kind of combining these. So there are ones that come from the extended affine vial group, which is basically just saying, if I change lambda by an element of the extended affine vial group, I actually get the same space, but written a little differently. And I take the graph of that isomorphism. And then when I have a path, there's sort of a different thing I can do. So if I have a path between two things, the way to think about this is at each point in the path, I choose, you know, one of my things. So I choose a section, and I choose a principal bundle, and I choose a sort of flag structure on that principal bundle. And as I move along the path, well, the section away from the origin is never allowed to change. And when I pass through the wall corresponding to an affine root, what I'm allowed to do, so this is if I'm just passing through one wall, here I have a copy of the affine flag variety for one Iwahori that corresponds to this side of things. I have a P1 fibration corresponding to a bigger parahoric, and then I have another P1 fibration coming down here. And the only way I'm allowed to change is I have my flag chosen here, I have some image here, so this is basically, for GLN, it would be forgetting one of the steps of my flag, and then I'm allowed to choose any pre-image up here I want. All right, so when I have a path, I just have all ways of choosing sort of coherently objects from my space along that path that change, that are only allowed to change when I pass this wall and change in this very restricted way that depends on what root the wall corresponds to. All right, the attached homology class is just pushed forward by the map where you only remember the end. Okay, so this is sort of a natural way of coming up with homology classes. And I just want to emphasize you have to be a little bit careful about this, basically because this involves taking a bunch of conditions and intersecting them. And you have to do that intersection like correctly in the DG sense. So I could say a lot of fancy stuff about virtual fundamental classes. What I'll actually just say is that kind of literal prescription only works if the path never doubles back over an interesting hyperplane. So there are hyperplanes coming from weights and hyperplanes coming from roots. And if I don't pass one of those twice, I can really do that sort of literal pick a flag and a section for each point on the path. And if I do double back, then I have to worry a lot more. So what I should do is just decompose my path into pieces that don't do these double backs, and then multiply the classes corresponding to those pieces, and not worry so much. All right, so the thing to think about is, if I have some path running around this space like this, so this means at each point on this path, I am choosing an element of the corresponding x lambda. And so the fact that the path crosses this red line is telling me something about compatibilities. It's saying the meromorphic section I choose has to be compatible with this guy, and compatible with this guy, and compatible with this guy, right? So these give me different rules. This guy allows, in the second term, a pole at zero. This one, but only first order. This says you can't have a pole. This says you can't even have a non-zero value at zero. You have to vanish. And I got to choose things that are compatible with all of those. So the issue about sort of virtual fundamental classes is if I start imposing that relation twice, I have to do that in an intelligent way. But as long as I don't double back, I'll never impose the same relation twice, and I don't have to worry about it. All right. So these classes I described, the graphs in the affine vial group, the elements corresponding to paths, and then just the usual cohomology of the space X lambda, thought of as an endomorphism, generate the morphisms of this category. So all the elements in this crazy BFN algebra I can write by composing these sort of basic things.
But the cohomology of X alpha does not depend on lambda, right? It's just cohomology of the fine flag, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's right. It's just polynomials in T star invariant under parabolic. And, you know, I can sort of think about lambda always generic, and then I don't even have to worry about the parabolic. But it's kind of nice to be able to think about zero. All right. And the point, at least part of the point of doing this is, well, I've written down generators. That's a good start. That's actually pretty hard to do if you just use this description with the affine Grassmannian. But even better, I can tell you what the relations are. And the relations are not that bad. So what's this relation? Well, this is exactly the relation that says I impose, you know, I have some rule for poles and zeros here. I have some rule for poles and zeros here. I make a choice here, I make a choice here, I make a choice here. I'm forced to say, take the same choice here. So the relation that comes from crossing this line is redundant. I imposed it twice, so I have to actually multiply by the corresponding Chern class.
What I'm saying?
Sorry?
I missed the word. You said you get multiplied by the corresponding what?
The Euler class of the normal bundle. So
normal bundle.
Yeah. So one of these guys is a subspace inside the other, and this is essentially push and then pull back. So you have to multiply by the Euler class of the normal bundle. All right. This is the green is not coming out very well, but this is a hyperplane corresponding to a root. And if I do that, that's basically averaging over a P1 twice. So I forget one of the steps of my flag, I pick a new one, I forget one of the steps of my flag, I pick a new one. Doing that twice gives me zero. This is essentially the fact that a de Maizière operator squares to zero. So I'm really out of time. I don't know, when am I gonna actually get cut off?
Tomorrow, probably.
Okay, good. So I'm just gonna note here, there. So this is some, some polynomial in this cohomology. And I just want to note it depends on where this hyperplane is. That's what this N is expressing. And then there's also a term MI, which I should think of as the weight of the flavor group acting on one of the weight spaces in V. That's what's explained here, but very small. But I'm usually going to be specializing to a maximal ideal in the equivariant cohomology for the point of the flavor. So these MIs are actually just constants, but the flavor group tells you which of them have to be the same. All right, now this open circle, that's one of the elements of the cohomology of X lambda. When that goes through a red hyperplane, one corresponding to a weight, just nothing happens. But when it passes through one of the green ones corresponding to a root, I get the rule for commuting a polynomial past a de Maizière operator. So it commutes past, but there's an extra term. Again, the colors aren't coming out so well. This is a purple guy that corresponds to the action of an element of the affine file group, the reflection across that wall. So I get, sort of instead of running headlong into this wall, I just jump over it, and my polynomial drops in degree to account for the difference. All right. If I go around a codimension 2 intersection of either root or weight hyperplanes, I can just slide through there, and there's some correction term for when I get an intersection with multiple kinds of hyperplanes. So I'm not going to try to write out what it is. It's a bit complicated. All right. So let me just kind of quickly say, what am I hoping to get out of this? What I'm hoping to get out of this is to understand the representation theory of this algebra. And the way I'm going to do that is by looking at weight representations, so representations where this cohomology, which is a polynomial ring, act locally finitely, and so it breaks up into weight spaces. All right, there's a lot of fancy and slightly confusing footwork with how doing this and looking at a representation of a category plays with this. Let me just sort of skip all of that.
root and skip all of that. So the important thing is what this presentation tells us about how different grid spaces relate to each other. So they say that if I look at two weight spaces that are separated by one of these root hyperplanes, then I get isomorphism unless this root hyperplane has a very particular value. So this n here is telling me which translate, which sort of affine thing has come from. And this is saying that only one of them counts, and only counts if it's integral. And if they're separated by a root hyperplane, then I actually get isomorphism. And I want to just say, why did I want to have this extended category? Because I drew a kind of continuous picture. So I really want to think of this as I have objects that sort of correspond to continuously varying this point, which doesn't make sense if I'm looking at weight spaces in my representation. So instead, I'm varying the object I look at in my category. And I say, aha, because of this relation. So this says that if I change the object in my category and I change the weight space by the same element of the affine bottle group, I get the same answer. So somehow part of the point of extending this category is I can change weight in this kind of continuous way rather than it being a discrete thing. All right. So one way to kind of formulate this is you can define an equivalence relation of weights where two weights are equivalent if the corresponding weight spaces in every representation are isomorphic. What I really mean is I want an isomorphism of functors of taking that weight space. And these rules are telling me when I get isomorphisms of functors. So I end up with two dominant weights are related in this equivalence relation if they're not separated by a very particular hyperplane. This is the hyperplane. There's one hyperplane coming from each weight of my representation. And exactly where I put that hyperplane, that says that that weight is equal to some scalar. That scalar is part of the flavor that I chose. I only count ones that are integers plus a half. All right. So what does this do? It means I can try to understand a whole module over this whole big algebra by only understanding a few weight spaces, right? So two weight spaces contain all the same information if they're not separated by some finite set of hyperplanes. So there are only finitely many equivalence classes amongst integral weights. And those classes are given by chambers in some hyperplane. Right? They're equivalent if they're not separated by something. So because I have this action in the vial group, I also get the things that are related under the finite vial group being the same weight space. So I'm only labeling stuff in one dominant vial chamber here. So remember, I'm thinking about GL2, so there are two vial chambers, this side of the plane.
So, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I'm curious about what you mean by weight. I mean, is weight a real weight or an integral weight? Or what? When I say that, somehow think about being separated by hyperplanes, and that's not the only kind of in the real picture, although theoretically you could consider things with any complex weight.
Okay, so this equivalence relation I define makes sense for weights over the complex numbers.
Yes.
Now, if the two weights don't differ by an integral co-character, then they cannot be equivalent. So if I want to, more generally, an indecomposable, you know, because when I look at the torus acting in the adjoint representation on the algebra itself, I only get integral co-characters. Two weight spaces that don't differ by an integral co-character don't talk to each other.
I see. So you're kind of implicitly assuming you have some indecomposable module over the algebra, and you're studying its weight decomposition.
That's one way to think about it, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, these sort of
saying
fancy
all of them will differ
by integral
shift from it.
It's just think about the functor of taking the weight spaces.
Okay.
and think about how those functors are related for different weights.
Okay.
And you know, the point is the category of representations breaks up into these pieces, and one way to say that is depending on what orbit under the extended affine violet loop you're in. So I should only look at one orbit. And once I fix that orbit, I get that a certain number of hyperplanes are relevant. And that has to do with things having integral values. So for a generic orbit, just nothing interesting happens. All the weight spaces are isomorphic. And you know, basically it's equivalent to the category of representations over some polynomial. And as I sort of become less generic, I get more and more of these hyperplanes that separate weight spaces that aren't forced to be isomorphic anymore. So the few of you who were in Oregon and saw my talks there heard me bang on about this for a long time. What you get is that there are certain weight spaces where a particular element of the algebra gives you an isomorphism. Because that's an element of the algebra, it commutes with every endomorphism. So it's an isomorphism of the functors of taking those weight spaces. Right? And actually, the element is nothing surprising, it's just the path that joins them. The whole point is because, a convex region, the path joining these two points never leaves the region and nothing interesting happens. All right, so another way to say this sort of theorem is the path joining two points gives you an isomorphism if and only if it doesn't cross any of these particular bounds. So the example I'm drawing here comes from GL2 acting on two copies of the standard representation. The reason I have two copies is I can put different values of m on them, and that's why I have sort of two copies of the hyperplanes corresponding to these weights. So this guy comes from one copy of C2, and this guy comes from the other copy of C2. And I've drawn in the root hyperplane alpha equals 0. So my equivalence classes of weight spaces, there are six of them, again, in a particular coset, sort of integral coset. So this is where looking at the stabilizer of the affine bio group becomes relevant. All right. And what I want to think about is what information do I need to take just one representative weight space in each one of these equivalence classes and reconstruct the whole representation of it. And I'll just say the sort of information I need is just the action of paths joining one chamber to the other, and also joining paths joining them to their images under the affine bound, and then coming back using these purple arrows. So this example is particularly important. If you lie on this chamber, crossing the root hyperplane using a path, and then coming back using an affine bound loop element isn't trivial. It acts essentially by one of these Demeser operators. Right? Crossing this hyperplane gives you a Demeser operator, and then using the affine bio group sort of sends you back without using one. But if I started here, I would have a path from this guy to itself, which went all the way down here, and then came back using the affine bio group. All right. I'll just say, I'm going to discuss this more in Toronto. You can normalize these paths so that they don't depend on which representative you choose, and such that the presentation of the satisfying becomes much simpler, combinatorial in nature, and is related to the geometry of Higgs. I'll just say, following down this road a ways tells you that the category O's for Higgs and Coulomb branches are causal. So this picture with taking weight spaces is describing the endomorphisms of some projective in the category of weight spaces, weight modules. Like the Coulomb branch, and you can relate that to X of simple modules of the Higgs. All right. And I'm not going to bother saying words about this. Just, you know, one thing to note, having these other objects in your category gives you very new, interesting, and maybe unexpected modules over the original algebra. And these algebras end up having a very nice interpretation, which is they allow you to construct a special vector nonetheless resolution called a Kropian generator. But proving that involves going through a lot of fancy vectors P stuff.
In what generals can you do this?
When mQuiddle is an actual resolution of singularities.
But always when mQuiddle is.
Yeah. I think, I mean, sometimes.
So in particular, in this case, do you know what generic means?
Do I know
not
what generic means? So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of basic. I mean.
This word generic means basically just that it doesn't lie on one of these hyperplanes. There are various kinds of generic you could be talking about.
I think there's a basic question about generic sort of when you have sort of when derived localization works. I mean, in other words, somehow.
Yes,
when
which is related to this.
Yes.
So that's not on this slide,
okay.
But I can tell you what this picture tells you about that.
So, but you do know the answer.
So, yeah, at least in some sort of generality. So, what I can tell you is when it definitely does give you a localization, it's hard to check that those are the only points where you have a localization, but it didn't somehow. So, it's basically you look at the toric version of this arrangement, like over FP. You take this arrangement, you think about the corresponding thing over FP, and you want all the chambers to have integral points. So it's a statement about like choosing a different quantization parameter involves moving these hyperplanes around, and you want certain chambers to have integral points of them. And sort of bad versions are exactly the ones where they don't.
I mean, it would be interesting to compare because I know there's an ongoing project of Zirconic of an open both, where one of the main obstacles is really, I mean, which they kind of overcome in some way, but I don't know exactly how. And, it's exactly to understand what is the space of single weights.
Mm-hmm.
Or single central characters, whatever. Just,
right.
It's kind of a priori statement that's a union of some hyperplanes,
mm-hmm.
but somehow which hyperplanes appear. This is, I think, they exactly have a hard time understanding this. And the reason is that somehow if you can see the complex, your complex sort of Cartan throw away these hyperplanes, then the fundamental group of what we get is supposed to act on the corresponding derived category. And they kind of construct that, but somehow the problem, I mean, they kind of do it, I think they basically do it for quiver varieties now. I think they probably have an answer for quiver varieties, which is not exactly what they're doing here, because there's some intersections, but I think it's kind of non-trivial to understand exactly what is the space of singular weights. And maybe if you can do it somehow in your way, that would be nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is sort of the ingredients are there to write that down, but like, you know, what the answer precisely looks like depends on precisely what you want. Right, because do you really mean the singular weights over like characteristic P?
Well, I mean, originally, yes, I mean, of course, and then they want to use it somehow. And then,
right, and you want, like, the rational weights that, like, even no matter how large a P you mod out by approximately.
Well, I mean, eventually you want that.
Yeah.
And how do you actually deal with characteristic P? Because of all this homology stuff, characteristic P somehow looks like it's sort of, I mean, do you actually work with homology, with mod P coefficients?
I think so. I mean, what I'll say is, you know, what I'm generally doing is taking this sort of picture with, you know, these paths and looking at these relations.
So you're just defining this thing algebraically by taking this generalizing relationship.
Now, I assume that would work the same if you just took homology with coefficients of
random homologies. I'm a little bit scared about thinking about dualizing sheaf in this context.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's still fine, but you know, it's not.
Okay. Well, this is certainly one of these points where, at least for purposes of this talk, I say, well, you just pretend algebraic topology all works the way you expect, and you don't worry about it. Is it really going to be a problem?
Maybe not. I mean, I don't know. It's a psychological problem for me, what I say. Like,
okay. I mean, you know, somehow the thing that I always reassure myself with is, you know, everything is cut up into pieces, which up to homotopy are the same as up to homotopy are points mod, like the algebraic group GLN for some n, or some product of GLNs. And, you know, the cohomology of that doesn't behave any differently.
Maybe it's fine. I don't know. I just don't. Yeah. Maybe there's no problem.
I suggest that we thank Ben for the great talk. Any further questions? Or should we continue?
So. And this if you said each bundle to zero, these are sections of bundles or homes between bundles on the front branch.
Each branch,
sorry.
I mean, home between lambda, each lambda corresponds to some bundle on the column branch, and
yes.
Home lambda prime are funds and sections of
yes,
of
I mean, right, so this was part of what I was saying about this GIT quotient and, you know, not worrying. That you can actually construct a vector bundle on of rank the size of the file group on this resolved Coupon branch. At least at the moment, I think I need smoothness to feel confident that that's actually proven, but you know. Yeah, there's such a vector bundle for each lambda.
Yes.
That works in the commutative set. And, you know, I mean, I should say that somehow all of that stuff is all a little bit in progress. So, you know, sort of I kind of reserve the right to be like, oh, I made a mistake. So it's sort of half written up, but
it's expected
how detailed it should be.
Yeah. I'm going to say the same thing. In the commutative setting, you might expect like, bundles on the kernel branch, or the line operators. In the theory, you should have weighted. Structural weighted category, like putting little defects on a disk and bringing them together, like a neutral fusion procedure. Does that happen here?
I have not thought about that.
Put two flags.
I mean, so, you know, sort of one thing that's certainly interesting is to think about these wall crossing functors that, you know, play into this story of Bezukhov and Kunkov that Sasha was mentioning. And of course, like tensoring the line bundle is part of that action of I shouldn't say affine breaker, but something with a flavor like affine. High one of a torus minus a certain number of sub tori. And you know, the sort of elements in pi one that are just going around the torus or tensoring the line. So it puts tensoring the line bundle in some bigger category or in some bigger group that involves other stuff. So maybe, and like what that comes from is these sort of operations of changing your quantization parameter. I don't know why this corresponds to changing your quantization parameter, but you know, sort of somehow you
the quantization parameter can be interpreted as one of these line operators.
Oh yeah, quantization parameter is exactly the so to say the flavor parameter.
Yeah. And then you know, like if you have an element of pi one in this torus, you can like lift that up to unroll the torus and look at how your quantization parameter changes. How corresponds.
But so I miss what you said. So how can we see this derived equivalences I mean, potentially, just can we see those direct equivalences on this language, or?
Yes. So, I mean...
Characteristic P or characteristic zero? Do you use characteristic P or can you do it directly on characteristic zero?
So, I mean, what... It depends on what you mean by that. You know, what... And there's this sort of story where, you know, there's this combinatorics where I was only keeping certain of my hyperplanes. And when you go into characteristic P, that kind of calculus changes because, you know, before I like had a Z's worth of these hyperplanes and I only chose one of them. And now I have an FP's worth that live on a circle and I only choose one of them. But if you think about all the sort of same combinatorics and same local relations, but you do all your diagrams in torus instead of in all of TR, then, you know, what you get over FP is actually like the representation of this BFN algebra. And if you do it over characteristic zero, it gets you the endomorphisms of the corresponding Tilden generator. So like, you know, I can sort of give you a presentation of the endomorphisms of the Tilden generator, and I can tell you by modules, where tensoring those give you kind of the positive elements in this wall cross integration. And somehow one of these kind of, once you accept this philosophy of doing things, you just always do the obvious thing. So I mean, in this case, it's like you look at the Coulomb branch for this bigger algebra, including the torus of the flavor, and there's some natural piece of that that's a bimodule over the two different quantizations, right? And then if you think in characteristic P, those quantizations can actually be isomorphic, and that gets you the point of which we
want. So I suggest that we thank Ben and continue further discussion over coffee.